everyone, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Lid Publishing's podcast, Lid Radio. My name is Miro, and I will be your host for today's show. With me today is the author of two upcoming Lid books. It is Eric Elgesma. How are you today, Eric?
Very well, thank you, Miro.
It's great to have you here in the podcast. And for those listening, Eric is the director of strategic analysts at Friesland Campina. He speaks and lectures frequently on the topics of strategic analysis and data management. He is currently based in the Netherlands, and today he has joined us to talk about his two upcoming books, the Strategic Analyst Cycle Toolbook and the Strategic Analyst Cycle Handbook. And without further delay, let's just get into today's podcast, Eric. And my first question for you is, what inspired you to become an author?
Well, you know, Miro, we build a knowledge management tool in our company, which operates worldwide. And that tool that had in mind to map the world around our company, so the business environment. Now, over time, that tool attracted so much attention from third parties, other companies, even we had government people, inviting us themselves into our company and having a look. And that made us consider, shouldn't we start selling this tool as a service? Normally we sell cheese, but we considered selling this tool as a service. Now, if you want to sell something, you have to have a narrative. So to be credible, we needed to have a story to tell. And we thought, well, maybe we should write a book to accompany this selling of the tool. So I started writing off and say the tool is about knowledge management for market intelligence or strategic analysis, as you may wish to call it. And now that we had the incentive to do something with a book, we said, well, we should cover the entire field of strategic analysis, not just knowledge management side of it. So then actually the writing developed, and we had so much fun in the writing. But at some stage, we said, well, we keep on selling cheese and we won't sell the tool after all. But the writing had proceeded with such a lot of, say, pleasure and fun that actually the books are there now, but we still don't sell the tool. And we've meanwhile insourced the tool from somebody else. But the books are available and they tell the story about how we developed market intelligence over the past 15 years in our company and provide all the tools that we use internally also for other companies to benefit from.
Right, and what really fascinated me is that there are two books and they both complement each other. So what was the thought process when coming up with the idea of two simultaneous titles?
Well, there's a lot to say for a series of books on these topics as there are clearly defined separate, say, capabilities. There's a capability of how to find the information, the data that you need, but there's also the capability of how to make sure that you turn data into insights, which you normally call analysis. And there's quite something to say about how to manage data, which is the knowledge management tool, but which also is how to organize this function in a company. It is about the person, the profile of an individual. So there's different fields of the matter. And initially I had written it all in one book, but it became too big. And you try to please everybody by covering everything, and in the end nobody will like it. So the book may even get sort of intimidative because it's too big and it may scare readers off. So I decided then to take the tools, the analysis tools that you use when you prepare a strategy, I decided to take it out. So now on the one hand, you've got a full handbook on how to run market intelligence projects and how to organize for market intelligence in a company. And separately, you've got a toolbook which contains your recipes for strategic success. And there's about 19 different tools in more or less detail described, and literally like a recipe book. If you need to understand a particular feature of your competitors, you can use a particular tool. It tells you what indicators to use. And the total basket now makes, on the one hand, for those that just need tools, there's a relatively small book on the tools. And for those that want to implement market intelligence or and want to run market intelligence projects, there's to be a little bit more elaborative handbook.
Right, and I would like to sort of refocus the conversation on the books themselves, and especially data. It seems that analyzing and managing data is something which has really evolved over time, and even in the short term. Not only has it become a really big player in many companies across the world, but it's been, quite frankly, the discussion of events and speaking panels, etc. Why do you think that is?
Well, I guess, and I think there's quite some evidence in favor of what I'm saying, but as a data person, I should always say to my audience, please fact check this. But I think there's enough evidence that companies that embrace fact-based decision-making do outperform others. So as a company, I believe you've got two choices. Either you develop the capability to process data and to go to fact-based decision-making, or you simply fade away. Now, the latter is not an interesting option. So you see that in addition, you need... say to work without bias. And in the May 2017 edition of McKinsey Quarterly, there was this article on this German energy company RWE that had to write off billions of euro due to the missing the trends in their business environment, and also due to biased decision making. So they may have had the data, but they didn't turn those data into the right conclusions. So it's both missing what's happening around you as well as not properly interpreting the data that you have on what's happening around you. Now, afterwards, they introduced bias detection. So how can we prevent our decisions to be biased? And of course, I felt sorry for them, but I also thought if only they had realized this earlier. I would almost say companies can now better say buy the books and pick up all the typologies of biases that... that I described that may indeed creep in data analysis and collection. And of course, the RWE comes now out in the open with clear scars, but so these sort of scars I have myself. Now, I'm not sharing the scars, but I'm sharing the learnings. And the lessons that we've learned have now all been written down. The only thing you need to do is keep asking yourself the right question, and most of all, to ask them to a sufficiently diverse range of sources. And then, of course, you have to have a management team that's willing to act upon the answers they receive, rather than only to look for answers that confirms them in what sometimes may be seriously outdated views. The speed of change, you know, is increasing, and data can help you see that change. And you say, yeah, that's a cliche. Well, maybe some cliches are true. I talked to a gentleman from Hewlett Packard the other day, and he said, Eric, remember, tomorrow belongs to the fast. And I guess that wasn't an exaggeration. Data tell you how the world is changing, and I recommend anyone in business to rapidly consider how data science can contribute to your improving your business, because your competitor will. And you know the story of these two guys camping out in the wild, and then early in the morning they hear this hungry lioness roar. And then the one says, sees the other putting on the sneakers. And the guy says to his friend, why are you putting on the sneakers? Do you think you can outrun that lioness? And the other guy says smilingly, no, I don't think I can outrun the lioness, but I don't need to outrun the lioness. I only need to outrun you. I think that's what competition is like.
Yes.
And I think with the right data, that can, the right data analysis as well, that can help you be the faster runner.
Right, right, absolutely. And I want to focus on something which is I think an overall message within the books. And that is acquiring data is no big deal in the grand scheme of things, but getting the right data is. So my question is, how can we cut through the noise and get the data which makes a difference, as you say?
Well, let me be fair here, Milo. I don't think it's ever easy. What has worked for me in the company I'm with is to consistently focus on the decision you need to make. So what is the decision? What quality of decision making do we need depending on opportunities and risks related to that decision? And how much time can we afford to spend to prepare for that decision? And that depends, of course, on the value of the underlying matter related to that decision. So what indicators should we define that guide us in the decision? Take, for instance, payback time of an investment in business. And once you reach the point of the indicator, it's about time to consider whether you know where to locate the relevant data and the related sources of those data. So to get to the right data, you first need to know what decision you want to take. And then data form the foundation of the decision, but they only come in the process, at the very end of the decision definition phase. So taking this approach of being decision-led in your data collection and analysis, you can hopefully avoid too much data processing, and certainly hope to avoid collecting and processing data and buying data that you don't use after all. I know it may not be the full answer, but it's what worked for me.
Right. And do you think that perhaps we live in a data overload society? And if so, why?
Yeah, data overloads what you hear, data overloads what you can face. But I believe only those people live in a data overload society when they don't know what they look for. Then in that case, it's Alice in Data Land, you know. If you don't know where you're going, any data will take you there.
Yeah.
So I guess it's a matter of self-confidence, really. It's great to have access to an unlimited amount of data, but only when you still master the skill to ask yourself the right open questions and to think through whatever problem comes your way related to what data you need, rather than to say, I've got so much data, now what does it mean? What is the problem you're trying to solve? And say you compete against a large listed company, take a business example. Now, prior to your taking, say, a major investment decision, you want to understand the competitor, because the competitor may affect you in your marketplace. The amount of data available on large listed companies is endless. There's so much out there. But unless you first define what you need to know for your decision, so what do you need to know to take that investment decision that makes you feel comfortable, and what data would make you feel uncomfortable taking that investment decision? And only when you really put on clearly on paper for yourself, if I see the following evidence, I would take a decision to revisit this investment. And if I see this evidence, I will take the decision to proceed with this investment, that sort of, say, that sense of discerning what you really need, then it will help you look for the data, and the data you'll find, because you know what to look for. And of course, this way of working will take experience. So you may need the 10,000 hour rule, that you have to work and work and work, and upon working more and more, you will be able to find the answers quicker, because you know what the patterns look like, and that may take you 10,000 hours. So experience helps you there, but if you don't start, you'll never get there. So yes, there's a lot of data out there. It's a great help, as long as you're in charge of, say, support using those data to support your decision making, and it gets you completely confused when you don't know where you're going.
And can you perhaps give us an example of a tool that you yourself use to analyze data in everyday work, and you have found it works really well for you?
If I look from my responsibility at, say, market attractiveness assessments, then for sure profit pool analysis would be the first thing I would recommend to anyone. If there's no money in the market, don't bother to be there. And profit pool analysis relates to the ultimate indicator of value, which is pricing power. So if pricing power you have when customers or consumers are willing to pay for what you offer and will not rapidly look for other offers when you increase your price. Now, how do you get such pricing power? I believe by ensuring what you do is both relevant to the consumer or the customer, and it's unique. So in the absence of entry barriers for your competitors, you won't have that pricing power. And the opposite is much more common. An industry without entry barriers, everybody competing against everybody for every deal, and no one making money. And that type of industry you smell from a distance. When you hear a salesperson saying, well, you know what, about 60 to 70% of my volume in retail sales are sold in promotion. I mean, that single indicator tells you all. So if I would have only one indicator that I could use to look at an industry, I would say it's a profit pool analysis combined with pricing power. The moment you have those two properly substantiated, you have 90% of what you need to know for the market attractiveness.
Something that really sticks out for me is this idea of big data. And big data has become almost kind of a buzzword in recent years, and it's a topic of a lot of discussion. In your opinion, why is it so important?
I guess many people, and myself included, see that computing power today already is inconceivable. There's so much a computer can do in so little time. And data collection, also related to computer technology, is also faster and more automated than ever. And then on top, we have the Internet of Things with all kinds of devices communicating directly with your data collection that offers even more data. So I believe I recently heard that in the past 2 years, the same amount of data have been uploaded as in the entire history of mankind before. It's hard for humans, you know, to understand those sort of exponential growths. Now, you have all those data, you have the computing power, and that's what big data is about. But what next is, you have to analyze. And then I return to my older, my earlier point, what decisions are you going to substantiate? Because that, at least for the time being, is where humans are still critical. This is where big data needs small humans for making progress in business. And those companies that have thought through what data or data patterns they will need to see to taking better decisions, they will come out as winners. So yes, there is big data, there's companies, but ultimately it's the companies that know where they want to go and then know where, what to recognize in the data to make them even more successful that are, I believe, are going to be the winners. It's for the first time in history that the top of the Fortune 500 companies in terms of market capitalization, they're all data companies. We're talking of the likes of Google, Amazon, Facebook. They're all data companies. They hardly own assets. The only assets they have is knowing better what a consumer does and wants, etc. So the data and big data is definitely a source of big value, but you need to know where you want to go. And data won't tell you unless you know what to look for. So there's so much data which is out there, but it's your analysis and it's your view on where to make money, and then your view on what data to support or reject those hypotheses that make the difference. And yes, big data can unlock a lot of value, but the analysis still is a thinking process, which so far artificial intelligence, I believe, can't do. But the opportunities are huge, and I recommend any company to review their strategies on data collection and analysis, but most of all on how data can help them build better strategies.
Brilliant. And actually, as I was listening to you talk about all the different aspects of analyzing and managing data, I want to ask you a bit of a curveball question that really sort of stuck in the back of my mind as we were talking. And that's, once we have data and we have evidence and we have reasoning, do you think that perhaps something like a company culture or a way that data is perceived, or perhaps even confirmation bias, can get in the way of businesses getting the results they need?
I guess so, yes, Mara. Confirmation bias is so human. If you see data that confirm what you're already thinking, you will definitely believe those data are correct, even when they're not. Because you feel comfortable by seeing something that confirms what you already believe. It's the way to deceive yourself. And it's not even intentional. So you must always be aware that data that pull you out of your comfort zone because they tell you a message you have never seen before, or worse, you don't believe is true. But the data may not be to blame. It may be your, natural reluctance to accept a truth that is different from the one you currently believe in. And those sort of, mental mechanisms, that's how humans are wired, those are often in the way of turning data into insights that bring companies forward further. That's what happened at RWE. They had a lot of insights, but the corporate resistance to accept those insights and turn them into a source of future value instead of ignore and reject them, and as a result being faced with massive depreciations later on because they had made the wrong investment decisions. It's so sad, but it's so human. And in order, it, knowing that you have these biases does not always protect you against them, but it may at least, by building the right, say, processes in your company, it may protect you from having a group that takes the wrong decisions. And the best way to do that is to have as diverse a group of people, preferably with very diverse backgrounds, not only in functional discipline, but also in cultural background, etc., and a culture where everybody's invited to speak their minds without feeling that if they don't say what the boss wants to hear, they may jeopardize their career. If you don't say what the boss wants to hear, or you believe what the boss wants to hear, you should actually be promoted, because you contribute to the quality of decision making rather than obstruct it. And building those sort of inclusive cultures in a company that contribute to better decision making is not easy, but it's definitely a culture that I believe winning companies embrace.
Right, absolutely agreed there. And the last question I would like to ask you, Eric, and that's the one I ask everyone on the podcast that joins us, is what are you currently reading?
I love reading, as you can imagine. I love your question too. Currently, I'm reading The World is Flat by Thomas Friedman. And you say, yeah, that book is a decade old. I know that. And I also read it to some extent to learn how one of the sharpest observers of our time, the guy, I think he won several Pulitzer Prizes, etc. So he's a sharp mind. And he assessed the future of competition a decade ago. And I'm reading it currently also to sort of wonder, now, what does it mean when 10 years after you look at those predictions, and where has he been right, where has he been wrong, and what data, say, did he have to already assess those futures? So that's fascinating. But I've just started reading, so I can't share too many insights yet. What I did completely read recently was a book which also fascinated me, a little bit more on the history side. It's called The Silent Deep, and that's about the history of the UK submarine service. And then it's a 600 pages written by two UK professors in history. And then after more than 590 pages, suddenly the Cold War is over, because it's describing the period from 1945 till the 1990s. And then the Cold War is over, and then suddenly, after all this blood and sweat and toil and a little bit of tears, these Russian, say the ultimate nemesis, the Russians, are talking to the UK Navy people that they've been haunting each other in the deep seas for so many decades, and now there's a sort of a new situation. The Russia-West relation has completely changed, and now even the navies have contacts. And then the UK officers ask their Russian counterparts, you know what? How did you perceive the British Navy in those years? And then the Russian guy says very bluntly, you know, but also honestly, we loved your professionalism, but we really didn't care much about you, because it was only the Americans that we were worried about. And now you've read all this blood, sweat, and tears, and then at the end of the day, it didn't really matter to the Russians. But at the same time, the only time that the UK submarines were heavily used was militarily, was in the Falkland War. But the British never assessed that Argentina would be their enemy. They always looked at Russia. Now, in business, you see exactly the same. You always look up. You look up to larger companies, more successful companies, but at the same time, you're attacked from being, say, from companies that are trying to be eating your market share, which may not be the larger company, but it may be startups or newer companies. So I think it's, again, an example of asking the wrong questions. So I think you shouldn't ask the question, who is my beloved nemesis? I think, to whom could I be the nemesis? Because that's the company that's going to be after you, and that may not be the market leader. So I always love to draw these sort of history parallels as an amateur, and that's a great way to spend time with books, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely agreed on that. And with that, I would like to thank you very much for joining us today, Eric, on the podcast.
Well, it's my pleasure, Milo. Thanks for your questions.
Absolutely. It's It was great to chat to you. And of course, for our audience, if you would like to know about Eric's work, and indeed Friesland Campina, you can visit them at frieslandcampina.com, and you can find them on social media at LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at Friesland Campina. And on Twitter, that will be at Friesland LND Campina. And once again, thank you very much, Eric. And we look forward to seeing you on the next episode of LID Radio.